U.S. trade deficit widens again.
What's that going to cost us?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good day to you. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, August 11th. The government told us this morning Americans continue to buy a lot more from other countries than we sell to them.
Also, the overhaul of U.S. financial regulations might affect a lot of companies, but not so much Goldman Sachs. And put down that Merlot if you're looking for a job. But first,
the gap between what the U.S. imports and what we export grew again in June. We got that word from the government this morning. Here to tell us what it means is our Wednesday regular, economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research, joining us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
The trade deficit jumped 19% in June. I thought a recession would make us demand less stuff from abroad.
Well, that's generally the case when the U.S. economy slows down, as it has in recent months, though calling it another recession, I think, would be going too far.
Mm-hmm.
When we slow down, generally our demand for foreign goods, i.e. imports, slows. We've seen exactly the opposite in a very big way in the past couple of months. So it is a little bit puzzling, but nonetheless, it is what it is. And one implication is that it's going to chisel down our growth rate. In the second quarter, the government's first guess was that the economy expanded at a 2.4% pace. Given this number and some others that have come out since their first guesstimate, that's likely to be somewhere in the vicinity of 1 to 1.5% now, which is a pretty substantial markdown.
Even our infamously enormous trade deficit with China is nearing record levels. Wasn't China working with us to bring that down?
Well, China did begin to let its currency rise about 7 or 8 weeks ago. It's been very slow. They've only let their currency climb about 1 percentage point. Most economists thinks it has to rise about 20 or 40%. So at that pace, it'll take years getting back to something that resembles fair value. And this is going to increase trade tensions in Congress, I have no doubt. It's been a simmering issue, and this is only going to bring it more to the fore.
Okay. Economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. Good to talk to you, Richard.
My pleasure.
A government analysis of crashed Toyota cars has brought a little good news for the automaker. Investigators say they have no evidence that Toyota's electronics are the culprit for those bouts of sudden acceleration. So does that mean drivers are to blame? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Horwich.
Toyota has admitted two major problems with its late model cars: sticky gas pedals and gas pedals that get trapped under the floor mat. But a potentially more damaging theory suggests the car's internal computers may be malfunctioning and speeding people into accidents. Using special diagnostic equipment supplied by Toyota, transportation officials examined the black box data from 58 crashed cars. In their report to Congress, they say there's no evidence of any electronic problem. In fact, human error may be largely to blame. Hans Greimel is Asia editor for Automotive News.
Toyota's been saying all along that they've double-checked and triple-checked and quadruple-checked these electronics and that they're sound. The critics, however, would say that just because you have no evidence that there's a problem doesn't mean that there's not a problem.
Greimel says Toyota's not out of the woods. The government's investigation continues, and hundreds of pending lawsuits will generate their own studies of what went wrong. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
The ban on deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico goes back to federal court today in New Orleans. Now, opponents of oil drilling often say we should embrace alternative energies like solar power. But so many Gulf Coast residents depend on drilling for their living. Can they really welcome the alternatives to oil? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
Here's one of the photos that I took. Derek Mann, he's off.
I first met Nolan Hart through his website, energyindustryphotos.com, where, surprise, he posts photos of oil derricks and pump jacks, stuff he's worked on during his 25 years in the Texas oil patch.
There is kind of a beauty to the equipment and against the sunsets.
He loves working in the oil industry. It's earned him a good living and an appreciation for where energy comes from.
A lot of people refuse to acknowledge that oil and natural gas are what gives us the lifestyle that we enjoy, even when you go to make a daiquiri and turn your blender on.
Which is why I wasn't prepared when Hart mentioned in passing where the electricity for his daiquiris comes from.
About half of it or more comes from solar panels.
What? But you worked in the oil and gas industry for 25 years. But there they were on his house, solar panels.
You can just kind of see the edge of the, that's a 2-kilowatt photovoltaic system on the roof.
Going solar is actually something Hartz wanted to do for a long time, after he lived for a year on a sailboat and relied on wind and solar energy. So when his hometown of Austin set up solar tax rebates 2 years ago, he went for it, and the eyebrows went up in the oil field.
I get some kidding from my coworkers sometimes. Solar panels, you know, why would you want to do something like that?
They told him turning away from oil and gas toward renewables seemed like biting the hand that feeds them. But that's not how Hartz sees it.
We all need each other. For every wind turbine that's built, there's a smelter somewhere for aluminum. It's oil and gas-based energy that is building renewable energy infrastructure.
And when his coworkers poke fun at his solar panels, he reminds them.
You might not want to laugh because you'll probably have them on your roof too at some point. It all comes down to economics. And if something can be made cheaply enough and just sit up there on the roof and make free energy, why not use it?
Hart says between the worlds of black gold and green, there's a big gray area, one that the country's going to be living in more and more in the future. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can see those photos from Nolan Hart's years in the oil field. Gorgeous, placid, scary photos at our website, marketplace.org. Tomorrow, Chrissy Clark introduces us to another unusual suspect in the push for alternative energy in the Gulf region.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, August 11th. I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Giatakis. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us in the U.S. The near future of deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico could be decided in a case that begins today. A federal judge in New Orleans will hear arguments over whether the six-month ban on the drilling is legal. That ban has idled dozens of offshore drilling spots in the Gulf, many of which happen to be operated by BP. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us live from London now. Good morning.
Hello, Bob.
How critical is this offshore moratorium for BP?
It's pretty important. BP derives around 10% of its revenues from the Gulf. Obviously, all the oil companies operating there want this moratorium to come to an end. And it seems many people along the Gulf Coast who derive employment and revenue from the oil rigs, servicing the rigs and so on, they also want the moratorium to be scrapped. So it's not just BP and the oil companies.
And what about BP's longer-term future in the Gulf? How's that looking?
On the face of it, it's looking a bit more secure. BP's been talking to the Obama administration about finance and is now apparently close to a deal whereby it will use all its oil revenues from the Gulf to guarantee payments into that $20 billion compensation fund. Now, that seems to guarantee BP's continued presence in the Gulf. But as oil analyst Nick McGregor points out, this only secures the company's existing production in the Gulf.
I think the real difficulty comes with access to future drilling rights. And if BP were to be shut out of that area, then I think that shareholders would take a very dim view.
And he says there is this move in Congress to ban oil companies with poor safety records from getting new drilling licenses, it is still possible BP could be shut out of future Gulf exploration.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Bob.
China is coping with the effects of a different kind of disaster. The government in Beijing reports prices in the country spiked up in July. Massive flooding disrupted food supply routes, and it drove prices of food upward. Chinese officials say they are blaming heavy rain for all the problems. But as Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, some are pointing to China's rapid development as the culprit, too.
For decades, industrial logging in this remote part of the country helped drive China's construction boom and economic growth. It also laid the hillsides bare. But it didn't stop there, says environmentalist Wen Bo. He says local officials, fueled by government funding, kept going back to the hillsides for raw material to build more.
They had to get material from this mountain. They had to dig in the rock and get a lot of building material from this area. So this makes this area less stable.
Bo, who works for the U.S.-based Pacific Environment, says the massive death toll could have been prevented had local officials paid closer attention to sustainable growth and city planning instead of rapid urbanization.
They feel like, you know, by looking at the image of Shanghai, by looking at the image of Beijing, they feel like our development means more tall buildings.
Chinese government officials have avoided blaming the disaster in Gansu province on unchecked development. They say it's a result of record rainfall in the country. China's being hit with the worst flooding in a decade. Thousands have died, and more than 12 million people have had to evacuate their homes. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
India is fighting to remain a hub for the global spice industry. Its spice trading hasn't always been a blessing for India, what with Portuguese, Dutch, and British colonials often fighting over it. Now, some there are concerned about foreign companies muscling in on India's lucrative industry. Raymond Thibodeau reports from New Delhi.
This Delhi spice bazaar, known as the Kharibayoli, is one of India's biggest spice markets. Shoppers browse among burlap sacks brimming with cumin and bright orange turmeric powders, curries, and black pepper. Which explains the sneezing as people walk by. Varun Grover owns a spice shop and an exporting business here. He says India's love of spices runs deep.
Yeah, it's a source of national pride. Indian spices are the best spices in all over the world, so no other country can come and take over it.
But the biggest food companies in the U.S. and Europe are eyeing India's market, including McCormick. The Maryland-based spice giant is buying a stake in an Indian company called Eastern Condiments, mainly for a bigger foothold in India's domestic market. Alan Wilson is McCormick's CEO.
It's the largest market in the world for spice production and consumption. We've been sourcing from India for over 100 years, so we have a long relationship there.
But Indian spice traders like Grover are worried. They don't like foreign companies muscling in on their turf. Some exporters say it's unfair, since Indian spice merchants often have trouble accessing foreign markets, especially in the U.S.
We have expertise in selling in those markets. We can certainly help them with the quality expectations and access to those markets.
That's exactly what Sri Kumar is hoping for. He's deputy director of India's Spice Board, which has been trying to attract and partner with foreign companies.
The Indian companies can have more access in foreign markets. And similarly, the foreign markets, they can promote their brand in India also. So it's a mutually beneficial thing.
Kumar says it's hard to know who benefits more. But one thing is certain. Despite the global economic slowdown, Indian spice exports are on the rise. Last year, $1.2 billion worth of spices were shipped out of the country, an all-time high. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, August 11th. I'm Bill Radke. When you want to know about the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Federal officials are trying again today to figure out what caused the flash crash, the big stock drop last May when the Dow plunged almost 700 points in minutes and then quickly snapped back. Today, regulators are discussing how much they should blame something called exchange-traded funds. So, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer answers the question, what is an exchange-traded fund?
ETFs are traded like stocks, but they're actually funds tied to different baskets of stocks. A government study found that 70% of the most volatile trades made during the flash crash were ETFs. So are they solely to blame? Matthew McCall says no. He's president of the Penn Financial Group. McCall says ETFs may have played a role in the flash crash, though. They're traded in seconds, following market swings closely.
So day traders love it as day traders look for volatility. I mean, as a day trader, you want volatility.
But ETFs can create a kind of herd effect. Things happen very fast, and traders can get spooked easily. Charles Rotblut is vice president of the American Association of Individual Investors. He says that's what happened during the flash crash. Everybody stopped trading at once.
A good analogy is that someone
saw one person walking away from the party, not sure why they were walking away from a party, but assuming there was something going on, they left.
Before you know it, the party's over. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Results from Rwanda's election announced today show incumbent President Paul Kagame has won this week's general election with 93% of the vote. Since the Rwandan genocide 14 years ago, Kagame has worked hard to change his country's reputation and to make Rwanda a center for business in Africa. But as the BBC's Peter Gresta reports from Kenya, Rwanda's economic success has not been without controversy.
By any measure, winning 93% of the vote in a presidential election is emphatic. Since he became president in 2000, Paul Kagame has ushered in a period of political and economic stability. Rwanda's economy has grown steadily by around 6% a year, and he has attracted foreign investment by assembling one of the most efficient and least corrupt governments in Africa. At a news conference in the capital, Kigali, an election observer, Salim Ahmed Salim, said the election day itself had run smoothly.
Observers have found a well-organized and peaceful poll. The National Electoral Commission has conducted the technical aspects very well, providing confidence to the people to turn out in large numbers.
But the election observers qualified their conclusions. They said a lack of critical opposition voices marked the poll. That's because a series of murders and legal cases kept most of President Kagame's serious opponents out of the election. The Rwandan government said it wasn't involved, but the election observers said the country still needs to address issues of political participation and greater media freedom. Despite Rwanda's success, analysts insist that more political space will only encourage further foreign investment. In Nairobi, I'm the BBC's Peter Grester for Marketplace.
Here's an eye-catching headline from today's Los Angeles Times. Goldman Sachs could be largely unaffected by the government's financial overhaul. How's that again? There had been talk the investment giant would suffer the most from the new regulatory limits. Nathaniel Popper's article this morning suggests otherwise. He's on the line with us now. Good day, sir.
Hi, good to be with you.
How does Goldman avoid losing revenue in the face of all this?
Well, I think there are really two elements to this. One is that Goldman has long had a reputation for being the smartest guys on Wall Street. And I think what you're seeing here is their ability to really get ahead of this and look at the ways in which they might get around the rules, benefit from some of the rules that might, in ways that people might not have expected, proving once again that they are the smartest guys on Wall Street. I think the other element here is that really across Wall Street, there has been a growing consensus since the reform was passed that a lot of this might not be as bad as they had initially thought, and a lot of this might be stuff that they can really deal with in the long term.
And how are other banks expecting to fare?
Well, I think that already some of the restrictions on consumer cards and consumer banking have hit some of the banks like Bank of America and Citi. Those were regulations that were passed a bit earlier than the Dodd-Frank bill. But even they are sort of looking to the future and looking at sort of spinning off some of their more risky trading desks, spinning off some of their private equity or hedge funds, or moving traders around so that they can keep some of the income flowing into the banks while still sort of adhering to the letter of the law. And so even in other banks, you're seeing a growing confidence that there's going to be ways to work with this, particularly given the long time span that banks are given to deal with the regulation.
In other words, stay tuned. Nathaniel Popper writes for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be there.
And finally, a question for you. Are you drinking because you have no job, or just maybe you have no job because you're drinking? We're talking during the hiring process.
That's right. Researchers at the universities of Michigan and Pennsylvania have been conducting experiments that suggest you're less likely to be hired if you're a job seeker who drinks in a social setting where a prospective boss is checking you out. And get this, your prospective employer may have a bias against drinkers even if they also order a drink during your interview process.
That's the amazing part. Regardless of what the manager ordered, job seekers were perceived as less worthy candidates, seen as less intelligent, less scholarly, less intellectual if they ordered, say, the Merlot. The study's authors have dubbed this phenomenon the imbibing idiot bias.
Now, I suppose a lot may depend on how you drink. Bill, you're never going to get the job that way.
That could be the problem.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.